Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Porter in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. U.S. intelligence is helping Israel deal with threats.
They're embroiled in that fight right now against Hamas, who attacked them on the 7th of October in ways that we should not speak of here.
We'll have a report on how the Israel-Hamas conflict is affecting Palestinian children. The U.K.'s King Charles honored veterans on day two of his visit to Kenya. The surprising third-place finisher in Liberia's election will soon announce his endorsement in the November runoff. Chad's exiled opposition leader could return home this weekend. Uganda's military says it captured a commander of an extremist group.
It was the group was trying again to come through Lake Edward, but we have been having very good intelligence on them. We have been monitoring them until we got them today.
And electric vehicles hit the roads in Malawi. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Israeli intelligence officials are getting a helping hand from their U.S. counterparts as they focus on eliminating the threat from Hamas. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden reports.
Israel's intelligence agencies are looking inward.
They're embroiled in that fight right now against Hamas, who attacked them on the 7th of October in ways that we should not speak of here.
U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency Director Lieutenant General Scott Barrier at an event in Washington says that's why the U.S. is helping Israel see the bigger picture.
Try to understand what the regional reactions are to all this, what the Iranians are thinking. What the Shia militia groups are thinking in Iraq and Syria, what the Houthis are thinking and doing.
U.S. intelligence agencies have already helped Israel in another way, defending the nation's reputation against accusations last month that it bombed a hospital in Gaza, declassifying and sharing information that put the blame on a malfunctioning militant rocket. Jeff Selden, VOA News, Washington.
With almost daily incursions by Israel forces into Palestinian cities and towns to arrest people suspected of being linked to Hamas, violence has been escalating in the West Bank in recent weeks. Since October 7th, more than 120 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces and Jewish settlers. Many of the deceased are members of armed groups operating in the West Bank, but nearly 30% of the victims have been children, according to the UN. VOA's Yan Boicha traveled to the West Bank and has this report.
Here at the Jenin refugee camp in the West Bank, children play with toy guns in the very same place where Israeli forces killed two Islamic Jihad fighters just a few hours earlier. They run, shoot, and hide from imaginary enemies on this street. The bullet holes and bloodstains are still fresh from the recent battle. Some of the kids pretend to shoot into the air to celebrate the fallen comrades' deaths.
There's no fear. My only fear is God.
Jubar is 12 years old and has many plans in life. He says he wants to study, become a professional football player, and a fighter. Last Friday, we spent the day with him. He carried a plastic rifle, which had a picture of a friend who died while confronting Israeli forces.
He was here, and they were there. And then, boom, 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 he was dead.
Aizar al-Amer, a local commander in the Islamic Jihad militant group, was killed that morning. His funeral attracted hundreds of people in Jenin.
This is a scene that it's becoming more and more common here in the West Bank. This is another funeral of a Palestinian fighter that was killed by the Israeli forces last night. As you can see, there's a lot of tension going on here.
UN data suggests this is the deadliest year for Palestinians in the West Bank in 15 years. More than 120 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank since Hamas attacked Israel on October 7, killing more than 1,400 Israelis and sparking the Israel-Hamas war. Most Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces during incursions into refugee camps to arrest suspects linked to Hamas. Attacks by Jewish settlers have also surged in the West Bank, and the number of Palestinians killed by settlers has been increasing. In this small village near Nablus, at least 5 Palestinians have been killed by Jewish settlers in the last 2 weeks, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. Murat Obeh says he was shot.
I was sleeping when I heard the loudspeaker of the mosque announcing there was an attack and people needed help. I rushed to the scene and saw my cousin lying on the ground. I put him in the car, and when I was going back to help others, a bullet hit me in the back.
Every day, new posters of deceased Palestinians are being printed and posted on the walls of Palestinian cities. With the violence escalating, many here seem to believe that the war is drawing closer than ever to the West Bank once again. Yabwe Shah, VOA News in the West Bank.
On the second day of his state visit to Kenya, Britain's King Charles honored Africans who served with British forces during the two world wars before he headed to an urban forest to help highlight the crucial role of green spaces in cities. VOA Nairobi Bureau Chief Maria Madialo has the latest.
King Charles and Queen Camilla honored World War II veterans Wednesday at the Commonwealth War Graves Commission Cemetery located in Kariakor. Daniel Achini is CWGC Regional Manager for East Africa.
This cemetery, Kariakor Cemetery, is very important to us. Now, the king is here to first and foremost honor the sacrifices of the Africans and who served with the British forces during the World War I and World War II, and is here to support the non-commemorative project of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, where we are fighting, we are trying to look for records of Africans who served during World War I and commemorate them adequately.
A few veterans were present, including two said to be 104 and 117 years old, Achini told VOA.
Now, the veterans we have here are the living veterans of the World War II. They served during the World War II in various capacities, and because they are living and they lost their medals in one way or another, so the king will be replacing those medals today.
Next was a stop at Karura Forest, an urban forest in the heart of Nairobi, to highlight the crucial role of green spaces in cities. Charles were joined by the famous Kenyan marathon runner Eliud Kipchoge. Together, they flagged off a 15-kilometer Run for Nature event. Here is Kipchoge a few minutes before the king arrived.
It's really important for the king to be here. It's important for me to be together with the king, because if you want to perform well, then you need to run actually in a clean environment and breathe a clean air. This is our only home. We don't have another home. We need to conserve. We need to take care of it. But the only way to take care of it is actually to involve ourselves as sportsmen and sportswomen.
To honor the legacy of late Nobel Peace Prize winner, Professor Wangari Maathai, who ran a campaign to save Karura Forest, King Charles, escorted by Maathai's daughter, Wanjira, and local children who support environmental causes, took a forest walk to a tree planting site. There, Charles planted an Elgon teak with fifth grader and 10-year-old environmental campaigner Karen Kimani, who spoke to us afterwards.
I felt a bit nervous, but it all went well, and I'm very happy. It has been my wish, and I can't believe it happened.
Kimani, who has already planted more than 10,000 trees, explained she was chosen to lend a hand to the king after writing a letter to Buckingham Palace.
My mom got an email that it has been accepted. I'm going to plant a tree with the king.
The king leaves Nairobi Wednesday night and heads to the coastal city of Mombasa, where he'll spend Thursday and Friday. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Bok in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 2nd. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Uganda's military says it has captured a commander of an extremist group accused of killing two tourists last month. The extremist group, Allied Democratic Forces, or the ADF, has ties to the Islamic State group. Following the attack on the tourists, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni urged security agencies to ensure the group is wiped out. Ugandan military spokesperson Konadio Akiki tells viewers Douglas Mpuga that the captured ADF senior commander is in military custody.
The hunt for these ADF splinter groups that came to Uganda and unfortunately killed two tourists. This splinter group was got last night in a night operation that involved some of our special forces elements and marine on Lake Edward. The group was trying again to come through Lake Edward, but we have been having very good intelligence on them. We have been monitoring them until we got them today. And actually, with us alive, captured is Njovu Mbogo, one of the notorious commanders of ADF, who was sent to commit such atrocities on schools, on hospitals, on tourists. He was got today, and four of them were killed. He was captured alive. There are those two who jumped into the water. They also died. So it was quite a good operation, and our forces along the DRC frontier in western Uganda is fully manned and monitored to make sure that these splinter groups that are being sent or have escaped from the fire in DRC, where we are hitting them very hard, do not come here to cause havoc.
How high in rank was this Njovu you talk about?
Well, these are operational commanders. We may not know which rank he was holding, but these are operational commanders who have been always sent in different areas for different missions. But as far as we can say, he's one of the middle commanders of the ADF, who is very, very operational into the ADF ranks.
Of late, ADF seems to have gained strength with attacks both in DR Congo and in Uganda.
On the contrary, they have not gained strength. This is done usually by such groups. We can't hit all your camps in the DRC, and indeed we appreciate the relationship of the two governments to give us space to operate in Congo and have our air assets and surveillance systems locate these ADF camps and destroy them. You've heard of very many camps in the Mwalika Valley. Now we were allowed to extend our operations into areas of Mombasa, and we have hit some of the major camps of ADF, those who had moved, the leadership that moved that side. Today, as we talk, the command and control of ADF is shattered, and these targeted operations they are sending into the country are to divert us, and definitely there will be no diversion. We shall finish up their threshold, and we shall pick these splinter groups from wherever they hide and from wherever they go.
You've been fighting ADF for several years, many years. Is there hope that they could be wiped out or contained completely?
ADF was defeated at some point from the Rwenzori Mountains in western Uganda. And what they did was to go deeper into the DRC. As you know, we had no mandate from the DRC government for 20 years, and therefore this gave ADF time to move freely, to cultivate food, to recruit, and to do all sorts of things, including murdering Congolese wherever they would go. But through the two governments of Uganda and DRC, an understanding was reached, and we launched a joint operation with FRDC, the Congolese Army, in an operation called Operation Shuja. And what we are seeing today are the fruits of this working together with the FRDC, the Congolese Army, to bring about sanity in this area and stop the havoc and the terrorism that has been caused by ADF for all these decades.
That was Colonel Dio Akike, the UPDF deputy spokesperson. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Kampala, Uganda. In Liberia, the candidate who shocked the nation to win third place in the country's October 10 presidential election says his party will soon announce its endorsement in the November 14 runoff election between President George Weah and former Vice President Joseph Boakai, but Edward Appleton of the Grassroots Development Movement Party says any endorsement will be based on the values of his party and in the interest of Liberia. He tells me that his campaign for change resonated with ordinary Liberians.
The campaign was all about people. Many Liberians are experiencing all across the country serious levels of hardship. And Liberians are beginning to vote on issues, even though we are not there yet. But more and more Liberians are beginning to pay attention and understand the importance of elections and electing their leaders. So we went out there We did not have all of the resources like some of the major parties, but whatever we had, we did our due diligence by reaching out to the people, the grassroots, the people at the very lowest level, those who are considered to be underrepresented, marginalized, underserved.
Mr. Appleton, what do you think was or were your strongest constituents? Was it the urban area or the rural area?
Rural area was my strongest constituents.
How did that become?
Well, first, I'm from Maryland County, okay? And my father was one of those people who was a household name in Maryland County. We still have family. We still have friends. We even have people, brothers and sisters, who are out there. And also, I went to school in Lofa. I went to LTI. I still have contacts out there. I have friends and family in the Banga area. I have classmates. And so all of those networks, we went ahead and made sure that we were able to connect. And I had an exploratory committee set up when I was trying to run for senator in 2014. And I've always kept in touch with people. So we maintained this network throughout. And when we were ready, we reached out and we sold our message. Now, I'm not one of those people who is on the world stage or out there with this huge organization. I've always been a people's person. As part of my own effort to give back, I've always helped people. That was one of my strengths, my ability to interact with people, to treat them as human beings, and to reach out. And the message that we had, the message of change, the message of things that needed to be done on the national level to ensure that an enabling environment can be created for the ordinary Liberian to live a higher quality life. So, and that resonated, and this is where we are.
Your third place finishing puts you in a very unique position now. There are those who are talking about you and the other lesser finisher in the first round as kingmakers now. What role do you see yourself playing in the runoff election?
Well, we will not be bystanders, and as is well stated and implied within the political landscape, that we are the kingmakers, of course, in terms of an endorsement. But before we endorse anyone, we have to go back to our own party platform. And as we know within our party, we have to review and ensure that whomever we endorse, there is an alignment with our core values and our principles. And there will also be other determining factors. Primarily, our endorsement will be what the people of Liberia and our partisans want.
When do you hope to make your endorsement?
Well, it's work in progress. As soon as our negotiations team can conclude and we are assured that, you know, whomever we select, their own vision and philosophy and their own moral principles and moral values are aligned with ours, we will make a selection. I'm sure that our partisans are all eager to make a selection, and then we will announce it to the public. So that's going to be very soon.
Mr. Appleton, thank you so much, and congratulations for your performance.
Thank you very much, sir.
Edward Appleton is the presidential candidate of the Grassroots Development Movement Party of Liberia. He was speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. An official of Chad's opposition Transformers Party said its leader, Success Mazra, will likely return to Chad from exile by this weekend. Democratic Republic of Congo President Felix Tshisekedi announced this week that Mazra has signed an agreement with Chad's transitional government to return home. Tshisekedi is the facilitator of the Economic Community of Central African States for Chad's transition process. Mazra and other opposition officials fled the country last year during a government crackdown on protesters. Dulubai Jess Seda is the Transformers Vice President for Political Affairs and the Diaspora. He tells me the opposition wants a power-sharing role during Chad's transition and to participate in the upcoming elections.
Not only him alone, but all of the people who fled the country after the attack of the junta on the population on October 24th last year, including myself. I haven't been back to Chad since last year, and many others. In our party, we were about 500 people who were outside the country, but as of now, we managed to get most of them home, and we have the leadership team that's still out.
So what is the date or week of Mr. Mastra's return?
It should be probably in the next couple of days, but we haven't decided on a definite date, but it should be by the weekend.
I'm interested in knowing what did Mr. Mastra agree to that has convinced him to return?
The content of this agreement has not been made public yet, but we have always looked and search for the share of power in order to be able to contribute to the transition that we are in it right now so that we'll eventually get to a very transparent election in 2024.
So are you saying that power sharing was part of the agreement between Mr. Mastra and the government?
We always have been preaching this. And the reason why we have not been part of it since the beginning is because it's a one-way direction, and we did not agree to those to this back in the past simply because it wasn't beneficial. And as you can tell, those who have agreed in this first phase of transition until now have not done anything positive to help the people of Chad. As you know, the October 20th has been the deadliest and the bloodiest peaceful protest that had happened. So for those reasons, it's important for us to be able to have, you know, we say we need some checks and balances. And that's the reason why we think it's very crucial for us to get back into the country and get into the game in order to counterbalance anything that may go against the people of Chad.
So what are your expectations for this coming December 17 referendum on the Constitution? What are your expectations?
The Economic Committee of Central African Countries have decided to nominate President Tshisekedi from DRC as a mediator. So through him, we're able to draft this agreement that we agree on the principle of it, allowing us to get back into country and carry on the practicality of it. So in order for us to continue further with this transition, we need to my humble point of view, review the referendum and see things that can be adjusted, things that can be taken into consideration, or things that can be trashed in order to come up with something more suitable for the people of Chad.
So once again, you're saying that Mr. Mastra agreed to return home with the hope of at least power sharing leading up to elections.
Yes, that's the point. We want to be part of the upcoming election. There's no reason for us to be outsiders. We are in politics. And the main reason why we are into we created this political party is to aim for the presidency. We are not just creating a party to make noise. So our objective is to conquer the power through the democratic way. So it is important for us to be in the field and to campaign and to also be contributor of what this transitional team is doing as in order to make sure that the rules are fair to everyone who is participating in this electoral process.
Thank you so much again. It's so good to talk with you.
Thank you so much.
Dolemba Jaseda is the Vice President for Political Affairs and the Diaspora of Chad's opposition, the Transformers Party. He was speaking with us from Atlanta, Georgia. 1 year after Ethiopia signed a peace deal with the Tigray People's Liberation Front, ending a brutal conflict that killed hundreds of thousands by some estimates, life in the northern region is slowly limping back to normal. But the legacy of 2 year war is everywhere in Tigray, even though fighting has ceased and access to key services, including banking, electricity, and internet, has resumed in some areas. Many Tigrayans told the French news agency, the AFP, they were struggling to find their feet after the November 2022 peace agreement, some losing their homes and livelihoods to the war. Others grieving family members killed in the conflict. The fighting, which also drew in Eritrean forces, left Tigray's infrastructure in ruins, with hospitals still lacking medical equipment and some schools yet to open. 1 million people remain displaced across the region. And that's it for this Thursday, November 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for being our guest this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa.